up to its bare metal driver's seat. The ground here along the pass was rutted by years of tractors' cleats clawing through the dusty lunar regolith. He himself had driven all the way around these softly rounded mountains, circumnavigating the crater. Not an easy trek, even in a tractor. Alphonsus was so big, its ringwall mountains disappeared beyond the short lunar horizon. The jaunt had taken almost a week, all of it spent inside a spacesuit that smelled very ripe by the time he came home again. But Doug had found the peace and inner tranquility he had sought, all alone up on the mountaintops. Not today. Even out here there was no peace or tranquility for him. Once he reached the crater floor, he looked beyond the uncompromising slash of the horizon and saw the earth hanging in the dark sky, glowing blue and decked with streams of pure white clouds. He felt no yearning, no sense of loss, not even curiosity, only deep resentment, anger, burning rage. The moon was his true home, not that distant, deceitful world where violence and treachery lurked behind every smile. And he realized that the anger was at himself, not the distant, faceless people of Earth. I should have known it would come to this. For 7 years they've been putting the pressure on us. I should have seen this coming. I should have figured out a way to avoid an outright conflict. He parked the tractor and walked along the side of the construction pit, gliding in the dreamlike floating strides of the moon's low gravity. Turning his attention back to the work at hand, Doug saw that the digging was almost finished. They were nearly ready to start the next phase of the job. The tractors were best for the heavy work, moving large masses of dirt and rock. Now the finer tasks would begin, and for that the labs were producing specialized nanomachines. He wondered if they would ever reach that stage. Or would the entire base be abandoned and left suspended in time, frozen in the airless emptiness of infinity? Worse yet, the base might be blasted, bombed into rubble, destroyed for all time. It can't come to that. I won't let that happen. No matter what, I won't give them an excuse to use force against us.
Greetings and felicitations!
Lev Brudnoy's voice boomed through Doug's helmet earphones. Startled out of his thoughts, Doug looked up and saw Brudnoy's tall figure approaching, his spacesuit a brilliant cardinal red. The bulky suit smothered individual recognition, so longtime lunatics tended to personalize their suits for easy identification. Even inside his suit, though, Brudnoy seemed to stride along in the same gangly, loose-jointed manner he did in shirt sleeves. Lev, what are you doing here?
A heartwarming greeting for your stepfather.
I mean? Oh, you know what I mean.
Your mother and I decided to come up now in case there's trouble later on.
Nodding inside his helmet, Doug agreed. Good thinking. They might shut down flights here for a while.
How is the suit? Brudnoy asked.
Doug had forgotten that he was wearing the new design. Fine, he said absently, his attention still on the digging.
Do the gloves work as well as my engineers promised me they would? Brudnoy asked, coming up beside Doug.
Holding out a hand for the Russian to see, Doug slowly closed his fingers. He could feel the vibration of the tiny servo motors as they moved the alloy bones of the exoskeleton on the back of his hand.
I haven't tried to crush any rocks with them, Doug said, half in jest. But the pressure is not uncomfortable, Brudnoy asked. You can flex your fingers easily?
Nodding again, Doug replied, about as easily as you can in regular gloves.
Ah, Brudnoy sighed. I had hoped for much better.
This is just the first shot, Lev. You can improve it, I'm sure.
Yes, there is always room for improvement.
The suit Doug wore was a Cermet hard shell from boots to helmet. Even the joints at the ankles, knees, hips, shoulders, elbows, and wrists were overlapping circles of Cermet. The ceramic metal material was strong enough to hold normal shirt-sleeve pressure air inside the suit, even though the pressure outside was nothing but hard vacuum. Thus, the suit operated at normal air pressure,
instead of the low-pressure mix of oxygen and nitrogen that the standard spacesuits required. No pre-breathing was needed with the new design. You could climb into it and button up immediately. The gloves were always a problem. They tended to balloon even in the low-pressure suits. Doug's gloves were fitted with spidery exoskeleton struts and tiny servo motors that amplified his natural strength, so he could grasp and work even though the gloves would have been too stiff for him to use without their aid. "Maybe we could lower the pressure in the gloves," Doug suggested. "We would have to put a cuff around your wrist to seal..."
"Priority message,"
the words crackled in their earphones.
"Priority message for Douglas Stavanger."
Tapping at the keypad built into the wrist of his spacesuit, Doug said, "This is Stavanger." He was surprised at how dry his throat suddenly felt. He knew what the message would be.
"All frequencies from the L1 commsat have been cut off," said the chief communications technician. "Communications directly from Earth have also been stopped."
Doug's heart began hammering inside him. He looked at Brudnoy, but all he could see was the reflection of his own faceless helmet and the gold tint of the Russian's visor. Swallowing hard, Doug said, "Okay. Message received. Thank you." He waited a beat, then added, "Please find Ginny Anson for me."
"Will do."
An instant later, the former base director's voice chirped in his earphones.
"Anson here."
"Ginny, it's Doug. I need to talk with you right away."
"I know,"
she said, her voice sobering. "Where are you?"
"In the university office."
"Please meet me in my place in 15 minutes.
"Right."
Doug turned and started along the edge of the construction pit, heading for the airlock in swift, gliding strides. Brudnoy kept pace beside him.
"It's started," he said.
"I'll inform your mother," said the Russian.
With a bitter smile, Doug replied, "She already knows, I'm sure. They couldn't declare war on us without her knowing about it." Touchdown minus 115 hours, 55 minutes.
"So they've done it,"
said Ginny Anson with a challenging grin.
"Damn flatheads."
Anson, Brudnoy, and Doug's mother Joanna were sitting before Doug's desk. Anson was leaning back in her webbed chair almost casually. Wearing comfortable faded denim jeans and an open-collar velour blouse, she looked vigorous and feisty, her short-cropped hair still golden blonde, her steel-gray eyes snapping with barely suppressed anger. Joanna seemed calm, but Doug knew that her composed expression masked an inner tension. She had let her shoulder-length hair go from ash blonde to silver-gray, but otherwise she looked no more than 40. She was dressed elegantly, as usual. A patterned coral skirt, its hem slightly weighted to make it drape properly in the soft lunar gravity, and a crisply tailored white blouse buttoned at the throat and wrists where jewelry sparkled. Seated between the two women was Brudnoy, his long face with its untidy gray beard looking somber, his baggy eyes on Doug. Brudnoy's dark turtleneck and unpressed denim seemed almost shabby next to his wife's impeccable ensemble. His gray lunar soft boots were faded and shiny from long use. Although Doug's office was little larger than a cubbyhole carved out of the Ringwall Mountain's flank, its walls were smart screens from padded tile floor to smoothed rock ceiling. Flat, high-definition, digital display screens that could be activated by voice or by the pencil-sized laser pointer resting on Doug's desk. Doug kept one eye on the screen covering the wall to the left of his desk. It was scrolling a complete checkout of Moonbase's entire systems. He needed to reassure himself that everything was operating normally. The other two walls could have been showing videos of any scenery he wanted, but Doug had them displaying the security camera views of the base, switching every 10 seconds from one tunnel to another and then to the outside, where the teleoperated tractors were still working in the pit as if nothing had happened. The wall behind him was blank. Feeling uneasy as he sat behind his desk, Doug said, "Now, I don't want people getting twitchy about this. The base should run as normally as possible." "Even though Forays declared war on us," Anson cracked. "It's not that kind of war," Doug snapped back. "There's not going to be any shooting."
"Not from our side, anyway," said Anson.
The best we could do is throw rocks at him.
At whom?
Doug's mother asked testily.